for so long in America, and maybe this is true of many societies, the idea of living in the suburbs, of having your own home, of having the white picket fence, and having that kind of stuff is the thing that's the American dream,
sure.
You know, the thing that's pitched to people as the thing that you want to have. And that's very different than the idea of density. So when you talk about density, are you talking about where people work, where people live, both, or can it be one or the other?
It can be whatever take you want, but obviously if you work and live close by, it means that you don't need to use the car to go to work and back, which then means that you don't need to spend 40 to 45 minutes driving through that in a kind of a larger scale city. And it means that you finish working and perhaps you can ask your wife or your friends or your children to join you at work and have dinner somewhere instead of having these kind of completely dissociated lives. You know, here's work, here's living, and everything becomes not spontaneous. Everything needs to be pre-planned because there is the car in the way and the distances to be bridged. Mm. So it can be a lot more enjoyable as a city. So by density, I guess what I'm talking about is about proximities. Proximities, adjacencies that make it possible to enjoy the city in a different way from the typical 50s American dream that you just described.
Yeah, Levitt Town and all those things that were the pitched as the post-war America, the future, all those things. As you've traveled around the world, you're now in Beijing. Where are you originally from?
I'm from Argentina.
From Argentina. So you've seen lots of different societies and lots of different types of cultures deal with these kinds of issues. Is there a common theme that happens, or is there a common curve that happens throughout the evolution of societies? Are there things like that that can be learned about when we are thinking about how we do urban development?
I think there is a lot to be learned, but there isn't much in common, I would say, for example, between the European reality or the South American reality or the Chinese reality. I mean, the Chinese reality is one that after the counter-revolution, it was just about deleting the memory and the tradition and erecting new structures on the basis of a wild process of industrialization. So there is not much, or there's been not much thinking about the future of those cities.
And that's what's happening right now
in China? Yeah, this is a process that they are starting to think. When the cities have acquired an age of 10 years and they are already in process of decadence, they're starting to think, okay, we have done something wrong, you know. And then issues of sustainability, ecological kind of liaisons and so on start to kick in. The process of Europe has been much more gentle, no? It's been spread along a much longer period of years, and tradition has always had a very strong component. Most European cities have never destroyed their past.
Although wars have utterly decimated.
Wars, yes. But you know, if you visit Italy, for example, as an architect, it's almost like a nightmare because you cannot even build because they don't get rid of any of their past. So it's the total opposite side from China. And in South America, there are just too many financial problems, social problems, corruption problems that do not allow for the process of urbanization
that's not coherent. I mean, there's a massive urbanization, right?
Yeah. But let's say, let's talk about positive urbanization, which is the one that is, in a way, taking into account a projection, thinking about phases of development, thinking about possible scenarios, possible responses to different conditions that might arise at one or the other moment. That doesn't happen in there.
Are there areas or urban areas that architects like yourself or that you personally feel like, now there's a model, now there's a great example of how to do it right?
Any ideas?
No.
No, because
or just maybe even areas of cities, or you know, projects that feel like they're so forward-thinking they really are?
No, I think there are what we call study cases. I don't think there is one ideal city that could be used as an example for most developments or master plans of all other cities in the world. I think there are parts of cities, and there are certain cities that might be more relevant to certain other cities, for example. So, you know, we were talking about, I did a workshop with my students in Bilbao almost a year ago, commissioned by the mayor, because they wanted to reestablish the relationship between the city with the mountains, with a kind of green trail that they have, and they had the kind of highway cutting through. So, so the project was based not on a single strategy, but on kind of small tactics to reestablish that flow, to bypass, in a way, the highway and reestablish connections. So that would be a project, not because of the city, but because of the type of project and the intention of the mayor, that seemed not too dissimilar to some of the things that I've heard that that Juno would like to do in terms of reconnecting to the waterfront, for example. Mm-hmm. No?
Yeah, so, yeah, fascinating. Well, just some of the nuts and bolts about if people want to see Ava and talk to her more and hear more about this fascinating discussion, where can they do that?
It's at the Nickelodeon Theater downtown, and it starts at 6 p.m. this evening.
And are there tickets available ahead of time or anything like that, or just people show up
at the door?
Door. Is there a cost?
I believe there is. I don't know what it is. It's about $5, I believe.
And it's nominal. They'll let you in.
You will let you in.
If you show up, they'll let you in.
And it's a fabulous opportunity. I welcome Juno to come down and just have an insight to some of another person's perspective of the world of architecture and design. It's really it's a treat to have them in town.
Well, it's a treat to talk to you today.
Thank
but
you
thanks so much for
it's
coming in.
It's a treat to be here.
Yeah, yeah.
To have been by the glacier. My God, that is mesmerizing.
Right, absolutely gorgeous. Well, thanks again so much. And once again, that's the Alaska Design Forum happening tonight. Gold Town Nickelodeon Theater. It's Ava Castro from Plasma Studio, and James Bibb is here from Northwind Architects. And it's happening tonight at 6 o'clock. Thanks so much for coming
in
to both of you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, just a reminder that it is the Spring Pledge Drive here at KTOO, the 40th anniversary of KTOO here, 104.3 FM in Juneau, Alaska, and been hearing some great response from folks today. Encourage you to give a call at 586-3636 if shows like a Juneau Afternoon or things that you listen to and depend on. It happens because of you. And we appreciate your support. 586-3636 is the number to call, or you can go online at ktoo.org to keep this station bringing shows like this to you every day. Coming up in just a moment, Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor.
Hi, I'm Ralph Wolf from Yakutat. I'd like to invite you to the College Track 3 film premiere at the University of Alaska Southeast. Since 2004, the Alaska College Track series has shown the challenges faced by some Alaska Native students as they balance cultural obligations with work and school. Followed by a panel discussion with students Friday, March 29th, 7 p.m. at the Egan Lecture Hall at UAS. Gunashchish Achet Yisa Achi.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 27th of March, 2013. It was on this day, 1851, a group of miners called the Mariposa Battalion entered the Yosemite Valley, hoping to drive out a tribe of Indians so they could do some mining there. They thought they named the valley after the Indian tribe they were trying to drive out, but they got the name wrong. The tribe was called the Awanichi people. Yosemite was the name given them by other tribes as an insult. It meant those who kill. It was on this day, 1915, the woman known as Typhoid Mary was put into quarantine in a cottage in the Bronx. Mary Mallon, she was about 40, working as a cook in New York City, and every household she worked at came down with typhoid fever. Typhoid was common on battlefields. It may have killed more than 200,000 soldiers during the Civil War, but it was rarely seen in the wealthy households where she worked. In 1906, a doctor named George Soper noticed this strange pattern of outbreaks in wealthy homes, interviewed the families, found that they had all hired the same cook, and he finally tracked her down. Mary Mallon did not take it well when he asked her to provide a stool sample. She threatened him with a meat cleaver. He called the police, had her arrested. A stool sample was taken from her by force, and they discovered typhoid bacteria in her gallbladder. She admitted that she never washed her hands when she was cooking. They kept her in quarantine. She was released. She changed her name. She took up cooking again. She spread disease and death in her wake until they finally caught up with her again on Long Island, imprisoned her in the Bronx for the rest of her life, and she died of pneumonia in 1938. It's the birthday of John O'Farrell, born in Oxfordshire, England, 1962. For many years, he was a writer for The Spitting Image, a British satirical puppet TV show, author of a nonfiction book entitled An Utterly Exasperated History of Modern Britain or 60 Years of Making the Same Stupid Mistakes as Always. It's the birthday of the director and screenwriter Quentin Tarantino, born in Knoxville, 1963, raised in Los Angeles near the airport, high school dropout, worked in a big video store, watched movies all day, wrote screenplays. His first movie was Reservoir Dogs, 1992. 2 years later came his big hit, Pulp Fiction. And it's the birthday of Julia Alvarez, born New York City, 1950, grew up in the Dominican Republic, came back to New York when she was 10, author of books about being caught between two cultures. Her novel, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, came out in 1991. Also wrote a nonfiction book, Once Upon a Quinceañera, about the tradition of throwing elaborate 15th birthday parties for young Latina women. Here's a poem for today by Mae Sarton, Moose in the Morning. O wild and gentle beast, immense antlered shape, this morning in the meadow, like something ancient, lost and found now, promise kept, emerging from the shadow, emerging while I slept, wilderness and escape, you set me free to shirk the day's demanding work and cast my guilt away. You make a truant of me, this moose enchanted day, when all I can is see, when all I am is this astonishment and bliss. Moose in the Morning, Mae Sarton, from her collected poems, published by W.W. Norton and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And welcome back to a Juno afternoon on this partly sort of kind of wanting to be sunny Wednesday afternoon in Juno, Alaska. On the phone next with us is Professor Saul Neely from UAS. He's going to be starting a transgenerational suffering symposium, part of the UAS Honor Symposium. Saul, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about this. I don't know if I said that correctly, but it's a UAS symposium. It's part of the Spring Honor Symposium. Tell me a little bit about what that means. This is a new program, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. This year, UAS started a new honors program, and we're still developing it and getting our resources together, but it's a really exciting new program. And if folks want to know more about it, they can go to uas.alaska.edu/honors. But this event is sort of the first major event of the honors program. It's a spring honors symposium, and we've taken is the theme of this inaugural symposium, transgenerational suffering, with special focus on historical violence, memory, and repair. The idea for the topic came from work that we're doing in an honors reading seminar. So it's a one-credit class as part of the honors program, and students in that class are reading a book by Gabriel Schwab called Haunting Legacies, and the subtitle is Violent Histories and Transgenerational Trauma. And it's a really intriguing book. Gabriel Schwab actually identifies as a second-generation Holocaust perpetrator. She was born in Germany at the end of World War II, and she talks about what it means to have grown up and to be educated in the wake of the country that perpetrated the Holocaust. And she talks, for instance, about, even though when she was 15 years old, they watched Night and Fog in her class, and they heard and they learned all about the brute facts of the Holocaust, but there was still this infamous German silence, as she describes it, that pervaded her family and her community, her culture. And it was an attempt to sort of get at that, to deal with the political process and the psychic process of mourning across the bridge that divides perpetrators from victims.
So, this idea, this concept of transgenerational suffering, is something that, in her case, is described as a whole societal. There was a huge, obviously, the Holocaust and World War II, and the responsibility that Germany had in conducting the Holocaust was an overall dominating thing in a society. But is that also something that applies on a more personal level?
Yeah, absolutely. She actually, it's a really intriguing book because she does a really good job of dealing or attending to both of those levels. So she begins by talking about transgenerational trauma from a psychic and psychological perspective. And so she speaks from her own story. But at the same time, how whatever kind of psychic healing is made possible in the wake of transgenerational suffering or as a response to it, one still must attend to the political processing of it as well. And that's what her book is about. It sort of begins in the psychological dimensions, but goes beyond that toward the political as well.
And do you think that this is something, this idea is something that has concepts that you can transfer to life here in Southeast Alaska?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's part of why we set this up, because Gabriel Schwab is actually really close friends with Simon Ortiz, native poet, and they're working together. Gabriel Schwab moved to the United States about 18 years ago, and she's made this her adopted homeland, and in a sense, she has adopted the karma of the United States as well, the historical comma. So she's really concerned about genocide in the United States as well. And she appeals to a post-colonial theorist named Aimé César, who in his book on Discourse on Colonialism makes the argument that European fascism was in some sense the same fascism of colonialism that had historically been turned outward. That force of colonialism turned inward on itself in Europe. And that's sort of the historical roots of European fascism, rooted in race and bureaucracy and
right.
These kinds of concerns. So, from Gabriel Schwab's, gesture here to talk about transgenerational suffering across multiple contexts of war and genocide. That's precisely what we're trying to do. We're trying to deal with this issue both locally, with the history of colonial violence within Southeast Alaska, and attend to the transgenerational trauma that's opened by those wounds, and also globally and nationally.
Fascinating. Tell me a little bit about how the week is going to go here. This, what the dates are, and if people are interested in being a part of the symposium, what they can expect.
Okay. So the events start next week, and we have kind of it's part of the symposium, but we're calling it a pre-symposium film screening. And so we will screen Hotel Terminus, The Life and Times of Klaus Barbie, which is a 5-hour documentary on the life, career, and trial of Nazi SS officer Klaus Barbie, known as the Butcher of Lyon. And it's an incredible documentary, but because it's 5 hours long, it didn't get a lot of screening when it was released. So it's an opportunity. This opportunity doesn't arise very frequently to see the film screened in its entirety.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually going to start it at 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday, April the 3rd. We're going to run the first part, and then we're going to take a 1-hour dinner intermission, and then we're going to return to watch the second part. So that's the first event. The second event, or sort of the formally the first event of the symposium, is a two presentations on Friday, April 5th, from 6:30 to 8:30. Ordinarily, presentations at the Egan Lecture Hall start at 7, but we're starting half an hour early because we have two of them. And the two presentations come from Patricia Huntington, who is professor of philosophy and religious studies in the Division of Humanities at Arizona State University. And she'll offer a presentation with a reading from her book, Loneliness and Lament, in which she explores the transmission of trauma in mother-daughter relations. The second presentation is by Martin Beck-Matustic. He is Lincoln Professor of Ethics and Religion and the Director of the Center for Critical Theory and Cultural Studies at Arizona State University. And he'll read from his new unpublished memoir, Out of Silence, as he reflects upon philosophical, existential, and political themes as seen from the perspective of a second-generation Holocaust survivor. And I can tell you real quick, Martin's story is really incredible. He was raised in a Czech atheist intellectual family. He was part of the student dissident movement, part of the Charter 77 human rights organization. He was arrested for his political activity. He had to flee Czechoslovakia in 1979, spent 8 months in an Austrian refugee camp before coming to the United States. And here he became a Jesuit. Well, he was studying with Jürgen Habermas in Germany as a Fulbright scholar in 1989 when the Velvet Revolution occurred. He went back to Czechoslovakia in 1997 to get a hold of some of his mother's documents that he hid before escaping in 79. In those documents, he found an incredible secret that his maternal grandmother had died at Auschwitz, which means he was Jewish.
Amazing. Wow.
Yeah, and his family kept that from him.
Huh.
And so he's been exploring that, and he's been, this family secret that's just enshrouded
wow.
in silence.
It's fascinating. Saul, sorry, we're a little pressed for time. I'm sorry but I just want to say, so is that there's one other event that's part of the symposium as well. Is that right?
Yeah, there's actually two more, and
okay.
I'll be quick. Monday, April 8th, from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., we'll be at the Student Rec Center, and the students in the Honors Reading Seminar will host a community discussion on the book. And so your question about how are these concerns relevant to Southeast Alaska, that is the event at which we'll have these discussions, these difficult discussions. And then Friday, April 12th, from 7 to 8:30 at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall, Monica Osborne, who is an assistant professor of Jewish studies at Pepperdine University, will come and give a presentation called After Representation on Culture, Catastrophe, and the Midrashic Impulse. And she'll discuss various ways in which film, literature, and popular culture increasingly rely on non-representational modes to respond to the Holocaust, 9/11, and other traumatic moments in recent history.
Well, it's all part of the UAS Symposium. It's the Spring Honor Symposium, a new program. It's on transgenerational suffering. And how do people sign up for this, Saul?
Everything is free and open to the public. And if you want to know more, you can go to our Facebook events page. It's the UAS Spring Honors Symposium. And you can also get more information at uas.alaska.edu/honors. Contact information is there. People can phone me or email me or whatever.
Okay, great. Saul Neely, professor at UAS, part of the UAS Honor Symposium on Transgenerational Suffering starting next week. Thanks so much for joining us today, Saul.
Awesome. Okay. Thanks, Andy.
All right, terrific. Thanks.
Bye.
We're going to talk Folk Fest next. Mike Sakaris is here, and also Sergey Morrison. Thanks to both of you for coming in. Talk about some volunteer recruitment stuff here. We need some people to help out. Is that what's going on?
Well, exactly. The Folk Festival is a volunteer-run organization, and that's sort of from top to bottom. It's sort of, there are two features that a lot of people don't quite get about the Folk Festival. Oh, by the way, this is Mike Sakaris, the voice of Mike Sakaris. One is that the money for it doesn't just happen. The city doesn't give us any money. We don't get Centennial Hall cheap. We have to pay, $12,000 or so to rent that for the week, and that's just one of the costs. And so the key feature of the festival is that it happens because people are members. They become a member, and that money helps pay for things. But the other thing about the Folk Festival is that it has to have volunteers. We can't ever earn enough money to pay for people to do all these jobs. And so we need people to help out on stage crew. We need people to help out on the soundboards, easy jobs and harder jobs. We need people to help out on the membership table. And then there's just lots of other little things to do. And so every year we just need, 100 or so volunteers to do all this work. And some people don't realize. They just, people think it just happens.
But
that's not true.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It doesn't happen without a lot of work. And we want to encourage anybody who loves the Folk Festival and wants to even make it better for themselves to help out by volunteering. Because when you're involved in it, it just becomes much more special.
Yeah, Sergey, I know you as a musician, but you're also helping put this thing together.
Yeah. I've been a board member for about 4 years. And I started actually by, I think I volunteered on the monitor boards or something, and the thing is we have great people in charge, and so you might think, oh, I don't have any sound experience, I don't have any stage crew experience, but people will, Mike here and some of the other sound technicians and stage crew leaders will train you. You can put in, on the monitor boards, you can put in, so it can just be just a few hour shift or stage crew, we ask for a little bit longer, but it's pretty rewarding, and you get to see, you get a different perspective too.
Sitting backstage passes.
Yeah, pretty much.
pretty much. Yeah.
Laminates.
Yeah, man. And we take, you get a button, and there's refreshments back there to keep you fed and hydrated, and it's just a cool way to become a part of the festival. And, I know for years I took it for, I was like, oh, yeah, it just happens. Like,
yeah, right.
Poop.
Sure.
Everyone, just, it's this great free festival.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's just free, and so it must just happen.
Right. So we're looking.
Think
we're,
about it. I mean, it must be, I mean, from the inside, Mike, I know you've been involved for how many years now?
Since 1989.
Well, let's not count them up, but a long time. What is that week like from the inside? I mean, and even the week preceding and leading up, it's just got to be a little bit of managed chaos.
Managed chaos, I think. I know that starting probably tomorrow, I'm going to start making a bunch of phone calls, scheduling people to help out on the stage crew or help out with on the soundboards. And I do want to emphasize what Sergey was saying. We can train you. If you're physically capable and want to do stage crewing, we'll train you how to do it. It's not hard, and it's a lot of fun. If you're unsure about that but just want to be a part of it and do an important job, we have less technical jobs that just require paying attention. And if you can do that and know how to pass on messages, then you can be useful and have a lot of fun at the same time.
It's actually a great opportunity to get training to sort of figure out this stuff and become competent in these areas.
And that's happened. We've had people, a young person came through and got enthused about it, and he's in broadcast someplace in the Midwest.
There you go. Oh,
career in broadcasting.
Well,
I know what that's like.
Here.
That's a dead end. No, it's not. But it all started here. And actually, it is. It's such a great thing, and it sort of embodies the spirit of what it's all about. Mm-hmm. People getting together, volunteering. You know, maybe you're not an expert in every field, but we can figure it out. We're all smart people here. We can, you know, there's other people who have been doing it for a while and getting together.
So right now there's a lot of work to do, but come Monday when the festival starts on the 8th, it's sort of like the bus is at the top of the hill. It's got no brakes. And it's rolling down the hill, and it'll get to the bottom one way or the other.
Yeah.
And all we have to do is keep it on the road.
Yeah, there you go. All right, well, that bus is launching,
Oh, yeah, so but just real quick, you go to, we have a really convenient volunteer form to sign up. And this is how we can make it happen is you go to our website, www.alaskafolkfestival.org. You click on volunteer. There's a web-based form. You can fill it out, submit it, and it goes to us. And and you can say when you're available, and we'll contact you.
Yeah.
And you can also indicate what you want to do.
Yeah. So it's very
like
convenient.
The armed services.
Yeah.
You can put on there. I want to be one of those water skiers.
Yeah.
We don't do water skiing.
But that sounds great. So just go to alaskafolkfest.org.
Yep.
Is the website
Just Google Alaska Folk Fest.
Right.
You'll find it.
And then click on volunteer, and then there it is. It's the web form. You fill it out, and you'll get a call, or you'll get an email in a little bit. And
if you want to do tech stuff, I will call you or I will email you, and you'll hear from me, and you'll get scheduled.
Yeah.
And for the tech crew stuff, we have training on the setup day, which is April 7th. So that's a time when you can come and find out, that is really what I want to do, or maybe I don't want to do that, I'll do this.
Yeah, right.
It's a time of learning all aspects of the folk festival and helping out, seeing us change Centennial Hall into a folk festival stage.
And Folk Fest starts on the 8th?
Starts on the 8th. 7 o'clock.
Starts on the 8th.
It's going to be a great week.
When does the setup start for people who want to volunteer?
Some of the setup will happen a couple of days before. Sergey will be in first thing on the 7th, Sunday morning the 7th, to work on the backdrop, and then the sound crew will roll in and start setting up the sound gear at around 11 o'clock.
All right.
People are free to stop by, and there will probably be things to do.
Yeah, and that's another great time. The hall's open, so you can come by, introduce yourself to someone, and if you didn't have a chance to fill out a form, we'll point you in the right direction.
All right.
Like we'll
sign you up on the spot.
Yep. Okay, sounds good. Alaska Folk Fest coming up, and get involved and be a volunteer. Go to alaskafolkfest.org, folkfestival.org,
yep.
Or as Mike recommends, just Google it and you'll find the volunteer page and submit your volunteer page. Mike Zacharias and Sergey Morrison, thanks so much for coming in and have a great Folk Fest.
Yeah,
all right.
Looking forward to it.
My time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test. Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes. Don't wanna be a richer man. Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes. It's gonna have to be a different man. Time may change me.
All right. Had all David Bowie today. Again, yes. Well, we've had some really beautiful weather happening here. Mostly cloudy skies is the forecast for today. Partly cloudy. A little bit of a chance of rain and snow coming up on Friday. And speaking of snow, Jeffrey Clow is here from Eagle Crest.
Good afternoon, Andy.
How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Great, great. So spring skiing is kind of on us here,
spring
right?
Spring skiing is on us, and it is amazing, but I hate to say this, but the season is winding down. You know, we have 9 days left of the season.
It must be interesting for you guys because I think that spring season must be, you gear towards spring break, right? I mean, that is a week for you guys, right? And then after that, you kind of look around and go, wait a minute, the season's almost over.
Well, yeah, but then along with the season almost over, we're busy.
Yeah, right.
I mean, we've got events coming out our ears, so, you know, it's a very busy time. So
yeah, and as far as hours go, you guys are going to scale back to just weekends starting after this weekend, right?
After this weekend, we actually go 4-3-2.
Okay.
So we're open 4 days this next week, Thursday through Sunday. Then we're open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then Saturday and Sunday.
And then is that it?
And then that's it.
That's the end of the season. That takes you to April...
April 14th.
14th, okay, mm-hmm.
And
there
you go. Hours are on our website at skijuno.com, so if you missed this and you're like, what are they doing? Just go to our website.
But as you said, the end of the season, yes, it's a little bittersweet. It's the end of the season, but you guys go out with a bang.
We do. We
so
do.
Tell
and
me about what's going on.
This year just seems like this weekend is just chock-a-block full of stuff. Never mind that we're going to have some great skiing and snowboarding. We have the U14 State Championships, so we have 60 kids from throughout the state that are coming down ages 10 through 13 that are racing both Saturday and Sunday. So we're pretty excited by that. And then, of course, Easter is on Sunday.
Yes.
Yes.
Easter egg hunt.
Easter egg hunts, bunny chases. We
bunny
have
chases.
Bunny tosses. I mean, you know, it's just, we're all about Easter.
Poor bunnies.
I know, but no live bunnies were used at all in this.
So tell me, what are some of these things? I mean, Easter egg hunt, we know what that is. What's the bunny chase?
Well, I'm going to expand on the Easter egg hunt
just a little bit
because we have an all-mountain Easter egg hunt on Sunday, and the grand prize for that Easter egg hunt is a season pass for next season. So there's going to be upwards of at least 60 to 70 eggs hidden around on Trickster and Muskeg, Trickster and Willowa, and get out there, buy a lift ticket, get up there, and see if you can't win a pass
that
for next year.
That sounds really fun and, like, lucrative.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Plus, there's going to be some other fun prizes, too.
Very cool.
And I do know, I believe there's a ginormous Easter bunny that's involved in this Easter egg hunt as well.
Okay, so the Easter egg hunt with the ginormous Easter bunny, but then there's also the bunny chase.
Bunny chase. We've got a bunny contest, or bonnet contest at 12:30 on Sunday.
Okay.
And then for little kids, or for small children, we're going to do an Easter egg hunt on porcupine. So that's just Easter eggs
fun.
Filled with candy. Then we do a bunny chase up on Hooter for 6 and under, and then a bunny chase up on Hooter for 7 and older. So, Andy, you come up there.
But tell me, what's the bunny chase? What
do
you do?
Well, we have a purple bunny that comes around, hops, skis, you know, cartwheels all around the mountain, and you have to chase him.
And I don't know if I believe this. Is this really?
It's really true. It's really true. This is one of these historical events that I don't know how it ever got started.
No one can really explain it, but
nobody can. But we have a purple bunny, and he skis around, and he gets chased.
Sounds fun.
There's
no denying it sounds fun.
It's great fun. The younger kids, they're after the candy. I have to tell you, those older kids are after his tail.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, I can imagine those older kids are trouble.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's this weekend coming up. So then what? What's happening? Tell me about just a little bit about what's happening in the subsequent days you're open.
Next weekend, the first weekend in April, we have the sometimes annual Bill Tugman obstacle course. So that is on
that
sourdough.
Sounds fun. Yeah.
And that is a great fun. It's for all ages. Go up, run the dreaded pole for us, the hoops of fire, the tunnel of doom. So that's a great event.
You know, you saying that just reminds me. I also saw a recent one of the Eagle Crest snow condition reports mentioned that the terrain park has some additional features in it right now, right?
The terrain park does have some additional features. There are some jumps, and if you are ready to go big, let me tell you, you can go big.
Okay, cool. So that's really cool to hear about as well, yeah.
Yeah, and the terrain park is open Friday through Saturday and Sundays
cool.
from 10
All
to
right.
3, so that's
okay.
great fun. And then we're going to cap off the whole season with the annual Slush Cup on Saturday, April 13th.
Always a blast.
Yep. If you're 10 or older and you just want to see if you can make it across the pond.
It's always a challenge.
It's always a challenge. This year, those Mountain Ops guys have been working hard, and I think it's going to be more of a challenge.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, we all decided it was a little easy. It was too easy last year.
Yeah, I wasn't at it last year, but I saw a lot of the footage, and it seemed like, boy, a lot of people are making it, which is great. You want people to make it, but you don't want everyone. I mean, you know, you want it to be hard.
You want it to be a little bit of a challenge, and with the advent of shape skis and everything else, it's making it a little easier to get off those ponds,
Sure, the big
across.
Wide skis are like water skis now.
They are. I know some ski areas have actually done double ponds, so you have to go off two of them. But nah, we're going to keep it close to our chest what we're doing for
slush cup. But slush cup with the special features coming up. That's coming up the last weekend that Eagle Crest is open. Okay, 9 more days, so it's time to get up there. Some of the best skiing at all of Eagle Crest happens in the spring. It's just wonderful snow up there. It's getting warmer. It's super fun, and the daylight's out. It's beautiful.
And the daylight, it is. So, you know, if you've been thinking you should get up to Eagle Crest, well, you don't have too many more days, so you better just act on it. Don't worry about boating. You can get out there and go boating,
right.
Ride your bikes anytime, but you don't have all that much time left to go skiing or
That's
snowboarding.
Right. All right, Jeff Reclow from Eagle Crest, thanks so much. That's Eagle Crest Ski Report for today. And that's Juno Afternoon for today as well. Thanks so much to all of my guests for coming in. Thanks again, Jeffra, and thanks to everyone else who came in and talked to us doing a Juno Afternoon. We're going to start with All Things Considered in just a moment. Once again, the forecast for mostly cloudy skies for the rest of today. Partly cloudy tonight, a little bit of clearing there tonight, and partly cloudy skies tomorrow as well, with lows tonight around 27 and highs tomorrow around 39 degrees. Coming up next, here's All Things Considered, and we'll be with you with our funder drive. Our spring fundraising is happening. The pledge drive is upon us. And you can give us a call at 586-3636 or go online at kto.org and let us know you want to keep great shows like All Things Considered on the air.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In a second day of his...